This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Calling all fire bombers. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
As Western states burn this summer, there are too few planes and helicopters to help. We'll explain why.
Major League Baseball teams are trying to change how they handle social media posts by players.
A Michigan grandmother likes to celebrate milestone birthdays with flair. Hear how she marked her 90th.
And one of the biggest songs of the summer is a cover.
Who would have guessed that in 2018 we'd be talking about the band Toto and the song Africa in any kind of urgent way? Yeah, 35 years after that song was a hit for Toto, it's now another hit for Weezer, the 90s rock band, who has did a cover, and I think to their surprise and a lot of other people's surprise, has turned into a radio hit.
Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen on Weezer's version of the song Africa by Toto. That story later in the hour. The firebomber is among the scores of air tankers and helicopters attacking record-breaking wildfires in states across the West, yet demand for such resources far exceeds supply. For example, last month, as the Ferguson fire threatened Yosemite Valley, which eventually was forced to close, incident commanders requested air support. A call came back that nothing was available. Jennifer Oldham, freelance reporter at The Washington Post, says the response reflected a complexity of issues that offer many Westerners little reassurance about the future. Jennifer, set this up.
So what prompted this story was the fact that the global supertanker, it's a 747, converted into a firebomber that carries retardant. And that's been contracted by the state of Colorado and Washington and California to fight fires. And so it got us asking the question of, are there enough aircraft to go around? And what we found is, no, there certainly is not enough aircraft to go around right now to fight the record-breaking fires we've been seeing season after season. There's 70% fewer federally contracted privately held aircraft available today to fight fires than there were in 2000.
Wow. What's the reason for that?
There's a lot of reasons for that. This sort of soul searching over how the federal government should fight fires has been going on through four presidential administrations now, and that's by virtue simply of the fact that the federal government manages a lot of land out in the West. Most of the land west of the Mississippi is publicly owned. It's federal land, so the Forest Service is in charge of fighting fires on those grounds, and it costs a lot of money. 25% of the fire suppression costs are comprised of aviation, so it's expensive. The aircraft they were using were old World War II era bombers, and those were aging out, and they simply had become a safety risk, so they have to figure out what sorts of planes to use now and what sorts of arrangements they should contract for those aircraft.
Doesn't even seem like demand is even close to meeting supply. Supply meeting demand, rather.
Right. Demand is simply through the roof, right? I mean, I've covered wildfires for decades now as a journalist, and every year we hear fire officials say, I've never seen a fire behave this way before, over and over again, simply because our fire seasons are getting longer, the climate is warming, there's more fuel in the forest to burn, the forests have not been managed for decades. So there's all these factors going into play here that are just simply causing demand to far outrun supply.
Goodness. We're speaking with Jennifer Oldham, freelance reporter at The Washington Post. She's written a piece about there being too few firebombers to fight all these Western fires. Is there hope that things could at least get better? I know they can't solve it overnight or maybe even the next couple of years, but is there relief ahead?
So what's happening now is the market is trying to figure out how to address this situation, the private market. And that is going to be companies like Global Supertanker that acquire aged out commercial aviation resources like this 747. Global Supertanker's sort of vision is to acquire more 747s, and then states will have their own fleets, like Cal Fire has its own fleet of 50 aircraft. Cal Fire also is going to have access to some older aircraft that were aged out of the federal service that Senator Feinstein recently got signed over to the state of California. They need to retrofit those. So states are working to come up with their own solutions. The federal government also just issued in June a request for proposals for private companies to present them with plans to contract planes to them for next generation aircraft, larger air tankers. So folks are working on improving the size and safety and availability of fleets.
I was surprised too that in the story you mentioned that there's some debate about whether or not fire bombers are even all that effective.
Well, and that's become more relevant now as fire seasons grow to virtually year-round. Fires are more intense, they're longer, they're bigger. So there's been a lot of questions coming into play about whether or not it's effective to dump hundreds of thousands of gallons of retardant on these very hot blazes in the afternoon when the fire can simply run away from the retardant. It's not helping because essentially aircraft don't put out fires. Boots on the ground do. So when they drop the retardant, they need to know that there's firefighters coming in behind them to build the line. The retardant simply stops the fire long enough for firefighters to catch up with it. So if that isn't happening, then that is not helping the situation.
Thanks, Jennifer. Jennifer Oldham, freelance reporter at The Washington Post. It is 13 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Hey, glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. A new school year can be an exciting time, but many children also experience anxiety and worry over new classmates, teachers, and where they will sit at lunch. Maybe it's because of the way parents are addressing the new school year. How to Cope, from Adam Russo, child and family psychologist and author of a book, too, called Unwritten Rules, Real Strategies to Parent Your Child into a Successful Adult. Adam, what do you recommend?
Well, it's funny, you know, people talk about back-to-school stress and preparing kids for school. I've really come from the belief that parents need to prepare themselves for school. I think, you know, inevitably the kids are fine. Parents are usually the ones who kind of make or break a school year. So parents need to really start preparing for, you know, what are their fears, what are their worries, what do they want to see from their kids? And really working towards getting in the right mindset to help their kids be successful, and also understand that their kids aren't going to always be perfect, and to deal with the failures appropriately that come along the way and not treat them like catastrophic events, which, because all that does is increase the anxiety among kids.
Yeah. Do you think as parents we impose our stress sometimes, even if the kids were not feeling any?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you have kids who, you know, you could have kids who, you know, in their minds are doing, you know, kind of just fine. And then you have parents, you know, because of their paranoia about future, you know, what's going to happen to them, all these things that they really start, really trying to hammer home to kids the importance of whatever it is that they're doing. And now kids who kind of where things were okay, all of a sudden they're starting to question themselves, and then they get hamstrung, and then they stop, really kind of being as engaged because now they don't want to mess up because now they have to, appeal to their parents, and it becomes this whole cycle that actually doesn't need to exist if parents can relax a little bit.
Wow. All right. So what do you do if you're a parent starting to feel a little anxiety yourself?
Well, I think, I always start with, and the premise of my book is really kind of understanding as a parent, when we raise our kids, who do we want our kids to become? And I think most parents would say, well, yeah, I do. I want my kids to be successful, but success is really defined as a kid who's going to be raised to be independent and adaptive. And so as a parent, I think the real question is if parents are getting anxious and really getting worried about what's going to happen to their kids, I think the default question they have to ask is what I'm doing going to help my kid grow up to be more independent or more adaptive? And I think when parents really start to try to over-control things, they actually are accomplishing the opposite. They're making their kids more dependent and more rigid. And that does not translate well into older ages, when we think about high school, college, and, into adult life. So I think as parents, I think have to start with that fundamental question and ask how is it of what they're doing really helping their kids grow up to be adaptive and independent?
We're speaking with Adam Russo. He's a child and family therapist based in the Chicago area. He's also author of a book. It's called Unwritten Rules, Real Strategies to Parent Your Child into a Successful Adult. And we're talking about parental stress as the kids head back to school. How about approaching kids or encouraging them at certain ages?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think, you know, like I was saying, I mean, I think if the goal of the parent is to raise kids to be adaptive and independent, I think that starts at any age, right? I mean, I think there's just really simple fundamental things that go on in households, and parents have to start asking, are they contributing to dependence or not? I mean, for example, if you have kids in, you know, second or third grade, you know, maybe they might forget their, you know, their instrument at home. As a parent, you might run it to school once or twice, but at what point are you enabling dependence if they're forgetting it at home the fifth, sixth, seventh time, and now you're continuing to save them rather than have the kids adapt and deal with the consequence of their choices? You know, we all know as adults there's consequences to all our choices, but as parents somehow we protect kids from the consequence of kids' choices, and then we're surprised when kids are older that now they have to deal with consequences of their choices, but now they don't know how to. Well, we set it up that way. So we have to really look at what are we doing to mirror life at young ages as to what's going to happen when they're older.
All right. So tied to that, what about placing expectations on kids?
Well, there certainly has to be expectations. I mean, look, everyone has expectations. And I think, and sometimes, you know, we're good and we hit them, and sometimes we fall short. And I think parents, you know, there's this belief that somehow we can't make kids feel bad about themselves. I think kids sometimes should feel bad about themselves. I mean, look, no one's perfect. If kids make a bad choice or do something wrong, like maybe they should feel a little ashamed about it. I think as adults, we go through that too.
Yeah.
But again, we protect kids so much from feeling negative emotions that these emotions are foreign to them when they become adults, and they actually have to deal with them. And I think, you know, most parents, I really do believe, are working in the best interest of their kids. I do also believe in the phrase that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And
yeah,
I think that's
yeah.
a lot of what happens, that I think parents are trying to do the right thing, but in the end, it just leads to more bad things. And the more parents can accept that at younger ages, I think the easier it is on kids.
Thanks, Adam. Adam Russo, child and family psychologist. I hated hearing that because I think I'm guilty of that. Sometimes, not all the time, of protecting your kids from feeling bad. Yeek. Guilty. 21 minutes after the hour. On this weekend. Thanks for being with us. When the internet uncovered a batch of racist, misogynist, and homophobic tweets that Milwaukee Brewers pitcher Josh Hader had authored while in high school, it raised difficult questions. First among them was, why did Hader harbor such thoughts, let alone feel empowered to broadcast them publicly? But the situation is also prompting baseball to ask itself, how did Hader's posts live online for so long and without his employers seeing them? And what can be done to avoid such embarrassments in the future? Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Social media posts have tripped up a lot of people recently, including Major League Baseball players. Now, the league is trying to do something about it. Jared Diamond of the Wall Street Journal has the story. Jared, did a controversy involving Josh Hader of the Brewers change baseball's approach to player social media?
It certainly changed the approach of some teams and especially agents, because the Josh Hader situation, which happened the night of the All-Star game in mid-July, was shocking for a lot of reasons. The first and most important was the things that Josh Hader had tweeted while in high school were just horrific. They were beyond belief bad. So many horrible tweets. That's first and foremost. And the fact that he had these beliefs is a huge problem and something that maybe baseball can't control, but is just a larger issue sort of in society. But where baseball comes in is this, and that's he had been in the major leagues for over a year. He's been in three professional organizations. He's had an agent for over half a decade. And no one had ever seen these tweets. They were just sitting there on his timeline, just waiting for somebody to find them and bring them back up, which is exactly what's happened. I think it spooked a lot of people, especially agents, who realized very quickly that maybe their sort of process for vetting clients and vetting their social media history was not as robust as maybe it should have been.
Have some other players been caught up in the same thing?
Yes, they have. So after the Josh Hader situation, there was a bit of a spurt of this, of fans sort of going back through players who they didn't like, Twitter timelines, and looking sort of on a mission to find things that made them look really bad. Now, not all of them were as bad as the stuff Josh Hader had tweeted, but context gets lost over 5-6 years when these tweets were written. The internet doesn't really forgive very well, and there really isn't any nuance in these situations. So when there is anything on Twitter that you wrote in the past that is remotely compromising, let alone really vile, like some of the things Josh Hader had said, it's going to look bad, and it's going to be bad for that player. And that's what happened with two, three, four different players after Josh Hader getting caught up in similar situations.
We're speaking with Jared Diamond of the Wall Street Journal. Jared, what did baseball do after this incident?
Well, with Josh Hader, he was not suspended. He was not fined. He was not punished. I don't think baseball, under even the collective bargaining agreement, would have the ability to punish someone for actions that took place before he was an employee or part of the union of Major League Baseball. That said, he was sent to sensitivity training, and he's going to do some work in some of the sort of diversity efforts that baseball has. With some of these other guys, they may not have been punished, but beyond the sensitivity training, we'll see. I don't really know what that is or what it really entails. The biggest issue here, of course, is that what these guys did, what they tweeted while in high school, was terrible. And it's, nothing is absolving them of sort of what they said. I don't think it's reasonable or fair to say, well, they were 17, 18 years old. They didn't know any better. Well, they did know better. By 18 years old, you do know sort of the difference between right and wrong, especially when it comes to this racial or sexist or homophobic language. So I don't want to make it sound like I'm absolving them. However, I do understand why the league and why the union, why agents are saying we have to do a better job of making sure this doesn't happen again.
Does it seem like the public and maybe the teams have even accepted what Josh Hader and some others have said, that they were this way then, they've changed, they're not that way now?
Look, I think that's definitely something that's possible. And I do think that people sort of on the internet don't leave room for people to grow. I do believe that someone can be one way at age 18 and be a different person by 25, 26. I believe that 100%. Do I know that's the case with some of these guys we're talking about? No, I don't know what's in it.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal baseball writer Jared Diamond. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and advanced manufacturing. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka coming up this half hour. Why so many Americans are taking less vacation time these days. The hit song for the summer is a cover. We'll explain how that came to be and how a Michigan grandmother celebrated her 90th birthday. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. It's time for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at MichiganBusiness.org. Contact them today. The way you press, scroll and type on a phone, on a phone screen or keyboard can be as unique as your fingerprints or facial features. To fight fraud, a growing number of banks and merchants are tracking visitors' physical movements as they use websites and apps. Some use the technology only to weed out automated attacks and suspicious transactions, but others are going significantly further, amassing tens of millions of profiles that can identify customers by how they touch, hold, and tap their devices. Fascinating story by New York Times reporter Stacy Cowley. Stacy, what have you found?
So basically, as I started digging into bank security measures, I was startled, as I think many readers were, to find out that it goes a little beyond what we sort of knew about, and that what a lot of them are doing is literally tracking the physical way that you type, swipe, click, pause, the pressure you apply on your smartphone screen, the cadence and rhythm you use when you interact with your devices, and things like that. And using those through hundreds and hundreds of these data points that they refer to as behavioral biometrics, they can build up a profile of you and your movements and use it to figure out if you're really you or if you're a fraudster who's gotten hold of your credentials and is pretending to be you.
Wow. How popular right now are behavioral biometrics?
So one of the challenges of this is that the companies that use these things are not required to disclose it, and very few want to talk about it. It's certainly being used by a number of large banks and retailers. I generally found that it's been most popular overseas. Nordic countries have been really quick to embrace this. Some of Europe has been really using it. It's kind of just getting started here in the financial industry. I found that a number of banks were sort of piloting this or experimenting with it. A number of retailers, though, have already gone in with this. At least two of the top 10 largest retailers in the U.S. are using these technologies.
How about that? So another one of the items I think you pointed out was that Some of this technology can even determine the angle at which you're holding your phone, and that matters for security officials.
That was what caught my eye about this, is that it's kind of spooky, the level of personalization they can get to. One of the things that really made this take off in the last couple of years is your smartphone is equipped with a whole bunch of sensors, and developers can get in and take advantage of those. So some of the things that they measure are the angle you're holding the phone, the pressure you're pushing on when you type on it. They're measuring things like the part of your finger you use. It turns out that that's a fairly individualized thing. How quickly you type buttons. Sort of every element of how you physically interact with your device, there's sensors in there that can let them track that.
And this all in the name of preventing fraud, I guess, for these companies?
Yes, and what's striking about this is that this is taking off because it is a pretty effective security technology. One of the things that really struck me is one retailer I was aware of, the fraud rates are huge for these guys. I mean, they're dealing with vast numbers of fraudulent login attempts. One high-end company found that 99% of its login attempts were fraudulent. So for them, anything that can really cut through and help them identify when someone's using stolen credentials is really appealing.
Wow. We're speaking with Stacey Cowley, New York Times reporter. She's written a great piece on technology entitled Banks and Retailers Are Tracking How You Type, Swipe, and Tap. It might be the speed at which you type characters. It might be even where on the keyboard. Do you use the side buttons or the buttons along the top? How fast do you type? The angle you hold your phone? What about the accuracy of catching fraudsters?
Oh, that was the other thing, is that a lot of these technologies are extremely accurate. The companies generally say they're looking at accuracy rates in the 98 to 99% range. And, of course, a lot of this is self-reported because, as I said, this is not transparent. There isn't a lot of, like, peer review on these sorts of things. But certainly the customer companies that I spoke to said, yeah, they're finding that these technologies work pretty well. That's why there's growing interest in adopting them.
About that. Thanks, Stacey. Stacey Cowley, New York Times reporter. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Hey, by at least one measure, the average American now takes less vacation than a medieval peasant. What's the resistance? Well, overworking can cause serious health problems, after all. Analysis from Dr. John Huber, clinical forensic psychologist. Doctor, what's wrong with us?
Well, I think in today's work environment, we have a lot of advantages. You know, it is a capitalist society, and we do get rewarded by effort. So people are trying to make things end in a positive way for them. You know, we all want to look forward to that day we can retire to and visit the coast of Costa Rica or maybe the Dominican sometime. But the reality of it is we're still kind of afraid. What happens if my boss finds somebody better when I'm gone? Or what if when I take off for those 2 weeks, they realize they really don't need my person being there and they can function without me, especially when they're trying to keep their companies profitable. So we're getting this double-edged sword, and it's very difficult for a lot of Americans to let go of work long enough to unwind and discharge and get back on their feet.
I can remember a couple of years ago doing a story about how companies are actually pushing people to use those vacation days, and probably for some of these mental health reasons that you cite.
Oh, definitely. You know, it definitely is an advantage. It gives you a different perspective that oftentimes kind of refreshes projects that you've been working on. You kind of feel like you're stuck in, and taking that break off for a period of time is very beneficial that way. It lowers things like blood pressure, gets those under control. And, you know, we're still kind of like, okay, I'll take a Friday off, or I'll take a Monday off, take a 3-day weekend. We're still afraid, because we've gone through some difficult economic times. Now they're turning around. We're starting to see some very positive things economically. So it's probably a very good thing to talk about right now that, hey, we need to be looking at taking that vacation for that boost it gives us in our work environment.
For some people, can it be as simple as a 3 or 4 day weekend? Does that do it, or do you need longer than that to decompress?
Well, speaking to somebody who has, you know, their own business, a practice, and if I'm not working, there's no money being brought in. You know, I can't always leave my office and know that, you know, 2 weeks later, everything's going to be okay. I did that for years. I would take a 3-day here, a 3-day weekend there, maybe a 4-day weekend. But about 3 years ago, at my kid's request, I literally, you know, we took a full 2 weeks, we rented a big old mobile RV, and we went across the country, and we've never been more thankful for that, and we've taken vacations every year since. It was such a break that it benefited so much.
Wow. I'm speaking with Dr. John Huber, clinical forensic psychologist. He's also chairman of a nonprofit called Mainstream Mental Health, and we're talking about why people take such few vacations anymore. Do you think things might loosen up, given that the job market right now is pretty good?
That's what I'm hoping, and that's one of the reasons why we're out there talking about this. Hey, now's the time to take that vacation. You know, we have virtually close to full employment for the people who are looking for jobs, and actually, you know, I'm seeing businesses out there looking for people that they can't find to fill positions because everybody's got a good job right now.
Dr. John Huber, clinical forensic psychologist, also chairman of a nonprofit called Mainstream Mental Health. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. The surprise hit of the summer of 2018 is a song from the 1980s, resurrected by a band from the 1990s. Africa, a soft rock number that you heard there, was a relic from 1983, the year it hit number one for the group Toto. Fast forward to a fan's social media campaign urging the alternative rock band Weezer to record a new version. Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter John Jurgensen says what started as an ironic exchange with fans has become a hit and perhaps a sign of Hollywood's reboot fever influencing popular music. John, take us back to the future.
Well, who would have guessed that in 2018 we'd be talking about the band Toto and the song Africa in any kind of urgent way? Yeah, 35 years after that song was a hit for Toto, it's now another hit for Weezer, the 90s rock band, who has did a cover, and I think to their surprise and a lot of other people's surprise, has turned into a radio hit. So it crossed over from kind of a digital phenomenon to rock radio, and now it's kind of making a dent in top 40 as well, as people either discover the song for the first time or rediscover the song.
Right. Explain how this began and how Weezer came to choose Africa.
Yeah, it's a very 2018 story because it started with a fan request. A young woman, a teen fan actually in Ohio, got into her head that it'd be cool to hear one of her favorite bands, Weezer, cover Africa, you know, the soft rock hit from the 80s. And I think, I'm not sure exactly how she discovered the song, but she just thought those two sort of would go together. And as a kind of a lark, she started this social media campaign to try and get the band to cover it, and other fans picked it up. And then the band noticed it, and long story short, they did a couple Toto songs, one of them being Rosanna, and the other being Africa. And, you know, it got some attention when this happened because the band was responding to a fan, and people loved that idea, and they loved the sort of ironic quality of doing this, you know, sort of majestic song from the 80s. So it got some pickup there, and I think radio stations started playing it there, too. And, you know, the song never really lost momentum, and if anything, it's actually gained momentum over the summer as it's picked up popularity and just sort of spread around.
And this is the biggest song for Weezer, right, in a long time.
In a long time. You know, of course, they broke out in the 90s with, you know, Buddy Holly and some of these other sort of really fresh rock hits. And then they had some other, they had some hits in the early 2000s. I think Beverly Hills in 2005 was sort of their last kind of crossover pop hit. But it's been a while. And that's not to say they haven't been putting out music or succeeding. I mean, this is like a successful rock band with a lot of fans and that tours steadily and puts out albums, you know, every other year or so. So they've been doing their job and doing work, but this is the one song that kind of broke through for them in a mainstream way. So it's ironic that this old tune is the one that did it for them when they've been trying so hard to score hits of their own.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen. He's written a piece entitled, Even in 2018, It's Going to Take a Lot to Drag Listeners Away from Africa. And he's talking about the popularity of Weezer's cover of the song Africa by the band Toto in the 80s. This teenager who got this whole thing going, is she getting any royalties from this?
Just a lot of, I think, kudos and credit given to her over time. And yeah, that's about it. Unfortunately, the trickle-down economics don't really extend to her. You know, but the band's been, I mean, I think they've really embraced it. And of course, the other benefactor from all this is Toto, which is, you know, I've probably abandoned not many people have thought of or even spoken of for many, many years. Yeah. And they're really sort of basking in the love of all this, of this kind of reappraisal of their music, and I think enjoying the newfound respect.
How about that? Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter John Jurgensen. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour. on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. You're never too old to try something new and exciting. And one Michigan woman took that to the extreme. When Dottie Sambiago turned 90, she wanted something a little more thrilling than a party or maybe a nice dinner. She wanted to go skydiving. She was inspired by former President George H.W. Bush's similar approach when he took the plunge for his 90th birthday. Sambiago told WXYZ Television that she just tries to enjoy life because you don't know how long it will last. She says she was a little scared at first, like almost all would be after jumping out of a plane from 14,000 feet. The grandmother said that she thought her legs would bend like an accordion when she hit the ground, but after she landed safely, she gushed about it being a wonderful experience. Ms. Sambiago and President Bush aren't the only daredevils to skydive at their age. Robert Williamson of Seattle recently performed the feat for his 100th birthday in July. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news! There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.